Hi-ho, everybody out in Radio Land. This is Tom Cito, Disney animator, historian, and all-around wise guy. And you are listening to the Skull Rock Podcast.
Skull Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney, with your hosts, Eljon Goh and Dave Bossert.
Ho, 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 and welcome into the show. Skull Rock Podcast, where every week, Dave Bossert and I talk about all things Disney and pop culture, with never-before-heard stories, behind-the-scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films and pop culture films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and much more. I'm Eljon Goh, one of your co-hosts. I am a musician, a radio guy, longtime Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars and pop culture fan. And you can email me at Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm your other co-host and pal, Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you can email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. And I have to tell you, Aljon, I love getting emails from people. And we're getting emails from people all over the world, which is unbelievable. You know, this podcast has really just been resonating with folks, and we have a terrific audience. Lots of kind comments coming in, and I'm looking forward to today's show because we're going to have our friend John Kanemaker, the Academy Award winning filmmaker and author, artist, animator, teacher. He's going to be back with us today talking about books. And I'm happy to say this is our annual book show.
I love it. I can't wait. I can't wait to check that out. Another thing, and this is new to you, Dave. We have been listed in the top Disney podcast rankings.
What?
Yes. I didn't even tell you before the show, but oh my God. I wanted to capture
the absolute surprise.
I wanted to capture right the absolutely, absolutely the top surprise. In the top 100 Disney podcast, best Disney podcast to follow, we are on the list. And we are in at number 13, Dave, with a bullet.
Oh, lucky 13. That's what I love, my friend. Lucky 13. And, you know, it's unbelievable that we're so high up on a list of 100 we've only been on the air for a little over a year.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have to share the link with you on the chat here, but I'm going to be promoting this over on our social media, so you can check that out. But
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. So please,
I really do.
Yeah. So thank you, everyone, for that. We do appreciate that. And I have to also say that our listenership is up. We do appreciate that, Dave. I try to keep you updated, but I always. You know, within work, I tend to forget, but I'm calling up some numbers here, and
And by the way, while you're doing that, Aljon, I just want to convey a little story.
Okay.
And why I said lucky 13, because when I started working at the Walt Disney Company at Disney Animation Studios, right, I was in office 13 in A-Wing. of the original animation building on the Burbank studio lot.
Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And then my phone number, the extension, my phone extension in room 13, office 13, my phone extension was 1331.
What?
A radar number. Oh. You know, it reads the same front to back, to front. And also I was one of 13 people who graduated from the 13th class at Cal Arts.
What?
And yeah, I could just keep going on with 13 popping up all the time. I mean, it's craziness, but that's why I say lucky 13. I'm glad we made the 13th spot on that list.
That is amazing. So the 13 really does, you know, hold a lot of meaning for you.
Yeah, it does. And I'm just going to add this as one more entry in my 13 book, you know, where it says we for the first time, we made a list of the top. Is it the top Disney podcasts?
Yes.
And we're at number 13.
We're at number 13. Yeah.
I just sent you the link. It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
It's crazy, right?
So amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to share some quick numbers, you know, for you, but it looks like, and this is from Spotify. So we released 4,084 minutes of our podcast across 43 episodes this year. Wow. And 38% of our fans listen to us, Dave, and I'm going to keep this in mind because we may change our how we're releasing our podcast. But between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m., making it the most popular time for them to listen to our show.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and we are being, let's see, I think there was a global thing here. Hold on a second. I'm scrolling through the different the different graphics here.
Are we in 172 countries?
Oh, we're in quite a bit. I was going to say 34 of our fans listen to us more than any other podcast. So God bless our fans
Wow.
for listening to us. But yeah, we are a global entity, Dave. We are global. Yes. We're absolutely global. So this is just a wonderful, wonderful news. Thank you, Spotify. Thank you, Anchor. And we Apple are so and Apple everybody and everybody is. Else, yeah. You know, Amazon and all that. So thank you all for all of your support and just continued listenership and sharing the show and all of the industry friends that you and I both made that continue to listen and share the show on their socials as well.
And, you know, the one thing I would say to our audience is, you know, send us those questions, send us comments, and also send us suggestions. What would you like to hear about? Is there a particular topic you want? Do you want a certain guest to come on? You know, let us know what you'd like because, you know, we're here, we're entertaining ourselves, but we're also here to entertain you. And the more feedback we get, the better we can adjust and tweak the show.
So here's a new stat for you, Dave. So okay. We are also loved in six new countries. Okay. Denmark, Portugal, yes. Norway, mm-hmm. Brazil, and the Netherlands.
Wow. Well, hello to all of those folks out there. And Portugal is on my bucket list of places to go, by the way.
I love Portugal.
So our people out in Portugal, I'm going to be coming to visit your country one of these days when things lighten up with this pandemic.
Yeah.
And I will say Amsterdam, the Netherlands, yeah. I absolutely love. I love Amsterdam. Amsterdam's a great place. In fact, we had a great guest on, Jorn Klubin.
Yes.
Is from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
That could, and from Denmark.
He could be spreading the word out there. Right out there with all of his fans out there,
you know. So yeah. I love the fact that we have listeners all over the world. It really is terrific.
Well, I love it, and we do appreciate the support, everybody, and we do appreciate the emails. And once again, I'm gonna say leave us those 5-star reviews if you think we deserve it, and your feedback and your comments everywhere you get podcasts.
And I'm just going to say, we're number 13. We're number 13. We're number 13. I love it.
Right on. And now let's get on to some more hip hop hoorays into the news.
Skull Rock Podcast, this week in Disney and pop culture.
All right, Dave. We've got some news coming in. As always, we scour the internet for the latest pop culture news, and this one starts out with Disney. We have a new name to succeed Bob Iger as the chairman of the, or the chair of the board. I almost said chairman. We should say chair of the board.
Yes, and, or chairwoman.
Chairwoman, if you will. Yes. Right, and this starts here at the end of the month when Iger is set to leave Disney. It's an end of an era officially, with Susan Arnold, a 14-year member of the board, as a new chair who will be replacing Iger. Dave, can you give us a little history on Susan Arnold, or know a little bit about Susan?
Yeah, she's been on the board of directors of the Walt Disney Company since 2007, and she's very well respected. She's what's considered an outside director. Doesn't hold an officer position didn't hold an officer position at the company other than being on the board of directors. And she has in the past had executive positions at the Carlyle Group, Procter & Gamble, McDonald's, and a company, NBTY Inc., formerly known as Nature's Bounty. And I think this is great. Listen, this is the first time there is a woman as the chairperson of the board of directors of the Walt Disney Company in its 98-year career, wow. 98-year history. I have to say, this is part of the smooth transition that they're doing. And as much as I'd love to see Bob Iger, stay with the company for another decade, these transitions are inevitable. She's highly respected and Iger speaks very highly of her and was pleased with her appointment as the board chair. So I think this is great and we'll see what happens.
So for the uninitiated, you and I are both in companies that have had, chair people and CEOs and all that in the structure. Does that mean that she is Chapek's boss? How does that work?
Yeah. So essentially she would be one step above Bob Chapek. She's chairman of the board of board of trustees, but she's chairman of the board that oversees the entire corporation. And Bob reports to the board, Bob Chapek.
Mm-hmm. And the board really, as a group, take where Disney is and helps move it forward into where they believe the company should go overall, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, huge strategic investments and things like that go up to the board level. Even, building a new resort down in Walt Disney World, where they're going to spend $300 or $400 million or $500 million, those things go up to board level for approval. Buying a $1 billion cruise ship, that isn't just somebody saying, okay, let's buy it. Let's spend $1 billion on a cruise ship. There's a lot more that goes into those kinds of decisions. And there's a lot more people at the company on the board level weighing in on that stuff.
Yeah. When it comes to funding and the checks and balances, Chapek will say, this is why we want to make this, move. This is all the background regarding it. Board, would you approve this project for funding? Right.
Basically. Yeah. And, I think, in the past there's been periods in the company where you had, somebody like Michael Eisner, who was the chief executive officer and chairman. Of the board. And I kind of like the fact that they have that role split between two people because it does add more checks and balances to the operation of the company.
Right on. We look forward to seeing all the moves that she's going to make along with Bob Chapek here in the future. We follow that stuff very closely here on the show. Another thing we follow closely is the box office. And Dave, it looks like by all counts, the movie industry is bouncing back. We have had awesome box office returns for Eternals. Ghostbusters has been a huge hit. And now Spider-Man No Way Home has crashed Fandango and all other services out there. So tickets for Spider-Man No Way Home were supposed to go on sale Monday at midnight. which I guess is Sunday morning, I guess. So when Monday morning hit, and Spidey fans around the globe were shocked and like me, were trying to get their tickets online. And then all of a sudden services around the globe crashed. Regal had crashed. Fandango had crashed. AMC had crashed. So what are they to do? The internet was ablaze. Dave, is this a sign that things are on its way back?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And, those people who are predicting the death of the movie industry, or, you know, the at least theater going part of the movie industry, I think are wrong. I think people do want to go out, and especially, look, we're starting to close in on 2 years of this pandemic, and all the, you know, the shutdowns and restrictions and the social distancing and everything. I think people are just getting to a point where, come on, let's just go out there and enjoy ourselves from time to time. And look, I have to say, I'm cautious when I go to the movie theaters. I generally will go to an IMAX theater to see a film. It's a higher ticket price, but there is usually less people in the theater than if you go to a regular screen. And so that's, you know, part of my being cautious and, you know, wearing a face mask indoors and things like that. But I have to say, you're only going to increase attendance going forward. As the pandemic eventually subsides behind us, people are going to be more apt to be going out instead of sitting on their couches, which, you know, is a double-edged sword for a company like Disney. Because there's a lot of people who want to see these Marvel films and Star Wars films in a big, you know, theater on a big screen. And, but at the same time, the company is trying to grow subscribers for its streaming services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know? Well, I think that's going to be great for everybody. Ultimately, the window from theater to streaming releases has narrowed. I think Encanto, which has kind of been the quiet movie that Disney has in the background, is getting ready for streaming. And I think that looks to be a really great film, you know, much like I enjoyed Raya and the Last Dragon and so many other things that hit Disney Plus, Hawkeye, for example. And Dave, have you even seen Hawkeye yet?
I have not. I've had a crazy week. Yeah. And some of the things that I actually wanted to watch, I haven't watched. And the big watch for me was over Thanksgiving with the Beatles documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about that last week. And I since then I've been up to my eyeballs in trying to get some projects finished and things. So which I'm hoping the audience is happy about, because I am working on some new book projects and we'll talk about those in the new year. There's plenty of material out there for us to sink our teeth into.
Oh, I love it. Well, talking about sinking teeth into different things, you know, they just released all these character posters for Spider-Man No Way Home, as once again the internet breaks anytime Spider-Man happens. Mm-hmm. and it's great to see that you've got Dr. Octopus, you've got the Green Goblin, as well as Electro with Jamie Foxx in there. They all look great. I can't wait for some of these classic movie villains. Can you believe it's been 20 years since the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man with Sony was released with Marvel?
It's unbelievable. And, you know, I was so happy to see Doc Ock back and Molina.
Yeah, Alfred Molina.
Alfred Molina, he's just a fabulous actor. He's just such a great actor.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is great to see him in the aging is really, really good. And to see Jamie Foxx, and there was a big hint at Jamie Foxx and Tony Stark's arc reactor that they put out. Look, it's out there. It's not a spoiler if they put it out there. And Green Goblin too. And to do the Green Goblin, you know, just I can't wait to see who's underneath, you know, because we know that is coming from a different universe. And you know, it's great to see William Dafoe back into the fold, hopefully in some way. And we'll see William Dafoe, because he's a wonderful actor as well. And other other things that they're teasing. In fact, you know, I'm biting my tongue, Dave, because, you know, I'm working on a particular project and I can't say anything about it, but I've already seen the new movie poster for Spider-Man and I can't say anything about it.
That's okay. That's okay. You know, hey, Leo, let's not spoil it for anybody, you know?
No, we're definitely not going to spoil it, but I tell you another thing that, well, I am looking forward to Spider-Man. No doubt. The other thing I'm looking forward to is DC. You know, during the break, holiday break, Dave, wife and I did see Suicide Squad, the latest Suicide Squad for DC on HBO Max, which was amazing. And it looks like we have another DC hero who's playing both sides, working with Disney as well as Warner Brothers and DC. And we have now The Rock with a first look at him as Black Adam in the DC cinematic universe, as it will. And he looks great, you know? So we're looking forward to seeing Dwayne The Rock Johnson doing his work with DC and in the Shazam movies and the Black Adam movies, if you will, for that. And he's buff as all get out, man. I love The Rock.
He's always buff.
He's always great. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of Black Adam. And it looks like that will be dropping... Oh, when is it going to be dropping? In July of next year. So a nice little tease there from The Rock. So you can follow The Rock on Instagram and you can see a little bit of a preview of what he's going to look like. Speaking of looks,
I was going to say, speaking of The Rock, I saw a wonderful video. Maybe you've seen it. It went viral of The Rock giving away his Ford truck, Ford pickup truck.
Yeah, it was great.
It was really terrific to see that. And I thought, what an incredibly nice guy to do that, you know?
Well, once again, The Rock does give back. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for The Rock and Dwayne Johnson as a human being. But, you know, he found out he was doing that, his film reveal, I guess. He was doing some kind of a film preview for an upcoming project. And mm-hmm. he just went out and saw that there was a guy, a deserving guy, ex-Marine, former Marine, I should say. And I think he had some medical issues, but he's giving back to the community and gave his pickup truck away, man. What a heartwarming story. Love that.
Yeah. It was really wonderful to watch that video.
Yeah. And I think he'd do it. The Rock would do it. Even if the videos weren't running in the background, because he's just a nice guy. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. And I have to tell you, speaking of reveals and new things to look at, the new Scream movie posters have come out with they feature the main cast. So they've got several different movie posters. You got to love those, that Scream face.
I do. I'm a big fan.
The Scream mask.
Well, this is what I love, Dave. They're bringing the original cast back. So it's going to be exactly where they left off in 2011 when Scream 4 was there. And they brought Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, David Arquette. If you haven't heard about it, Ghostface is back. Who knows what's going to happen, but the original cast is in there, albeit more seasoned, but man, looking great. I can't wait to see it. So we're going to get ready to see the rest of Scream when it launches into theaters only on January 14th. That looks great. I can't wait. Big fan of that franchise.
Yeah.
In sad news, another, I'm a big fan of this gentleman in this TV show, Laverne and Shirley's Eddie Mecca, actor who played Carmine, the big ragu, had passed away Saturday in his home in Newhall, California at the age of 69. Dave, huge fan of Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days. It definitely was much watched TV for me growing up, and I love the big ragu.
Yeah, no, he was a great character. He was, one of those character actors that, you know, you would see from time to time, but he is known for Laverne and Shirley and very likable character. It's very sad, you know, I mean, 69, that's young by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. His cohorts there, Cindy Williams, had made little tributes to Carmine and Eddie Mecca as well. My darling Eddie, Cindy says, a world-class talent who could do it all. I love you dearly. I miss you so much, but oh, the marvelous memories. And
Michael McKean also weighed in.
Yeah, absolutely. He said, a sad goodbye to Eddie Minkah this morning. A genuinely good guy and purveyor of cheer whenever things got cheerless. Value these people. Rest in peace, Eddie. So just...
Michael McKean and Cindy Williams are really sort of the two stars that are left from that show. The two big stars, you know?
Yeah, exactly, right. And
Michael McKean, you know, he's in a lot of stuff. I have to say he plays the brother on Better Call Saul.
Yeah, he's still out there, but he's never stopped working. And Michael, you know, whether he worked in definitely comedy actor, he's worked with a lot of the cast members from Saturday Night Live and had worked in This Is Spinal Tap, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy is prolific.
He's a terrific actor.
Absolutely. Well, you will be missed. The big ragu. You're going to make heaven a much more happier place as a result, and definitely will be missed for all the fans of your work. And now, Dave, it's time for us to get in with our great interview. We've got a round two with one of our favorite guests.
Yeah, and you know, I'm happy to be able to say that we have our annual book show with John Canemaker. Right. And I have to say that because we have been on the air now with our podcast for over a year. And so we're at that place where we can do our annual holiday book show where we talk about book shows, where we talk about books. But anyway, I'm rambling. Let's just get to our friend John.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
All right, Al John, once again, we have John Canemaker. He's an author, an animator, a professor, and an Academy Award-winning filmmaker. And he's back with us again this year. I think this is becoming an annual event because this is our book show. So, John, welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast.
Thank you. I'm getting to be a habit.
That's right. And we love it, you know. But I have to say, John, this is always the time of year, you know, when we start to get close to the holidays, that, you know, it's the perfect time for people to purchase books and to give books as gifts. Because to me, books are an experience, especially when you get a good book. And so for that, I kind of feel like we do an annual book show because now it's going to be annual because this is our second time doing it.
Great. I'm glad to be part of it. Yeah. Shall we start, talk a little bit about some books?
Yeah, let's do that. I've read a stack of books this year, and they're all over the map. And I have no doubt you have too. So you tell me where you want to start.
Well, actually, I'd like to start with your new book.
My Claude Coates book. Okay, let's do that and get it out of the way. You got a beautiful copy. John is showing me a copy that we sent to him. There it is. Fantastic.
No, I really was impressed with the book. It's a beautiful book to begin with, and my compliments to your wife Nancy Levy Brossett, who
yes,
a terrifically gifted layout artist and designer. It's a wonderful book. It reads well. I mean, the research is amazing in it. I didn't know a great deal about Claude Coates. But you've really filled me in on a lot of details, not only on his work as a, you know, the well-known background designer at Disney. You know, he worked on Fire Brigade and Pluto's Judgment Day and the Old Mill and everything from Snow White through Lady and the Tramp. I knew that. I mean, but the details that you got into, I mean, I didn't know he was 6 feet six.
Yeah. Oh, no. And you know something, when I first met him, you know, I'm a 6 foot tall guy. But when I met him in the commissary at Imagineering, I looked up at him. I mean, he was a tall guy.
Yeah. It's sort of like Diane's husband, Ron. He was like mountain person, you know, person that you looked up to. But besides that, I mean, you got into the whole thing of him becoming an Imagineer. That was a really, a very interesting story because he got into it through luck, didn't he? I mean, he was.
Yeah. I think there was a little bit of luck to it, but I also, you know, I've always said, and I don't know how you feel about it, but I think Walt Disney, I think one of his greatest talents was that he was a great casting director. He could see in people things that he knew he could do, that the person could do that they didn't know they could do.
Yeah. Well, I think he certainly did that with Claude Coates. I mean, he came in and said, the people who are supposed to do the Mr. Toad's ride have, you know, failed to do it. And you guys do it, meaning Ken Anderson and Claude Coates. And they did. And then little by little, he kept using him to create attractions, rides for Disneyland. And then he became an Imagineer.
Yeah, and you know, it's sort of an interesting thing because it was a bit of a transition, you know. Mm-hmm. It was Walt asking him to do, you know, the model for Toad's Wild Ride, and then once he had the model done, asking him to paint some small, you know, backdrops that went into the model, and then Claude thinking, well, that's, you know, a guide for the art director who's doing that, and he was happy to do it. And then the next thing you know, Walt coming in and saying, those guys can't do it, I need you guys to do it. So then he's all of a sudden painting these giant flats that are going to go inside that attraction. But he's also working on other things. You know, he's doing, you know, he's finishing off the illustrations for the Lady and the Tramp Golden Book. Mm-hmm. He's doing other backgrounds for some of the shows that were in production that were going on. But there was this sort of definite transition period that happened, you know.
And you make a nice gallery of his paintings at the end of the book, which is quite beautiful. I was very impressed by the Machu Picchu.
Yes.
1974. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And magical in its own way.
Yeah. And you know, the one thing that we wanted to do was we wanted to try and put as many of his paintings in there, and we put them in chronological order so that the reader can see his painting style transition from those beautiful watercolors that he was doing in the 1930s into his acrylic and mixed media work, you know. So there's really almost like six decades represented of his paintings.
I was interested too in the Haunted Mansion section as well, and particularly this rumor about a rivalry between Claude Coates and Mark Davis, which apparently was not true. But it's funny how people, you know, come up with things like that.
Well, and it's those urban legends that just become, it's almost a telephone game where they just get perpetuated by people who really aren't that informed on it, on the topic, but they've just heard these things over the, you know, over a period of time, and they just become more fantastic as the stories are relayed. Yeah. And we really wanted to tamp down and basically tell people there wasn't an issue, you know, and really what it boils down to is that when you know, John, you know this, when you get 400 or 500 artists together to work on an animated film, every one of those artists has their own artistic sensibilities.
Of course.
And you would do something different than how I might do something. But we can both appreciate what each other's doing.
Yes, and I can't imagine, based on what you've written about Claude Coates, anyone who is more mild-mannered and got along with people. And the same with Mark Davis. Everybody loved Mark.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we really wanted to, we made it a point to sort of set the record straight because, you know, Claude and Mark were friends. Claude and Evie and Mark and Alice had gotten together and, you know, they socialized together outside the studio and traveled together and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing. You're preserving information about people that really should be known,
yeah,
more widely in animation history and in the Disney oeuvre history of that as well.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And I will send you a check in the mail. No, but there's been so many terrific books that have come out, and not just on animation. I mean, I've read a number of books over the past couple of months. I read one, the Taking of Paris, the epic battle for the City of Lights, which begins with World War II and the Nazis invading and capturing Paris, and takes you through to the Allies liberating Paris. And I thought it was a fascinating read, and one that I really enjoyed, because I learned some new things about the metro stations in Paris. Some of the metro stations are named after French resistance fighters who were considered heroes during World War II. And so it was just interesting to read about some of the battles leading into the conquering of Paris. It was really a wonderful history book, really.
Sounds great. Sounds great. I've been reading three books at the same time. A Gemini on steroids.
Absolutely.
I like to pick up a book and, you know, find something to read and it interests me, and then put it away because I don't want it to end. I want to keep on, you know, coming back to it. And one of them I've found recently is a book called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs: A History of their Lost World, and it's a terrific book. It's by a paleontologist named Steve Brusati, and it's a terrific book because it gives you context to the rise and fall of the dinosaurs. He talks about the global dominance, you know, that they had for over 200 million years. I mean, can you?
Wow.
And then the shocking, you know, relatively sudden demise 65 million years ago. So we haven't been here as long as the dinosaurs, and I'm kind of scared the way we're going. We're not going to be either. But Brusati, you know, brings us along on fossil hunts. I mean, you're right there with him as they're discovering, you know, these bones. And he talks about paleontologists in the past, historical ones as well as contemporary ones. One of the first ones, I dived right into the chapter on Lizard King, the tyrant dinosaurs, because I love the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Sure.
And he talks about the guy who discovered those bones for the first time, and it was 1902, mm-hmm. man named Barnum Brown. And he was a bone collector, a young, 30-year-old guy that was sent by the Museum of Natural History. And that's still here in New York. And that's, if you've seen Winsor McCay's Gertie the Dinosaur, you've seen Winsor McCay in live action going into that museum and looking around for the dinosaurs. But Barnum Brown in 1902 was, you know, digging around in East Montana. And he came upon some of the largest bones that were ever discovered up to that time. And it was, it took 3 years to dig. They packed up the bones, they cleaned them up in New York, and by 1905, they were able to show these bones in completion, and it turned out to be the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the first time that it had ever been shown to people. It was a great sensation. Barnum Brown became very famous. In fact, he not only discovered more dinosaur bones, but he also worked at the Disney studio briefly when they were doing Fantasia, a consultant on the Rite of Spring for the design of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, and I wonder, because I wrote a little bit about this in the Claude Coates book regarding the primeval diorama and the T-Rex and Stegosaurus that, there was a outcry about the authenticity of those two dinosaurs living at the same time.
Exactly. They didn't.
Well, they didn't, but there was a relative of the I think it's the Allosaurus. Which was a relative of the T-Rex. But the bottom line is it's a T-Rex and a Stegosaurus. So they took some liberties.
A to him. And I think it's because, you know, Hollywood likes couples to meet cute. So they which looked great, with the Tyrannosaurus, who looked even better. And they went at it.
Now, is that dinosaur book, is it illustrated?
Illustrated, yes. Not correctly, not like a
Claude Coates book.
Like a Claude Coates book or any of your books, or even any of my books, but it's illustrated with photographs and some, diagrams and stuff like that. So it's well worth getting. It's a wonderful book.
Interesting. Very nice. One of the other books that I read this year was Wild Minds by Reed Mittenbuehler. I don't know if you've read that. You must have.
I reviewed it for the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, okay. And you liked it, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I liked that he credited where he got everything. I mean, it's kind of a book that was cut and paste from just about everybody who was an animation historian.
Yeah.
In the book, but he credits everybody. So I love it when, you know, books have notes, because sure. Then more research and you can find out where they got their information. Go to stuff that's not excerpted, but the real yeah. thing. What do you think?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good read. I liked his voice and I loved the stories. I loved the weaving of all of these names that, you know, anybody who's involved in animation knows, you know, Pat Sullivan and, you know, the Fleischer brothers and Walt and, you know, Winsor McCay. And what struck me most though, John, was the choices that Max Fleischer made and the choices that Walt Disney made and how, you know, Walt rose to stardom and Max Fleischer really sort of faded out because of some of the business choices he made.
Yeah, that was an interesting part. There were a number of, errors in the book, and I think people have been pointing it out online and elsewhere. But I agree with you. It's a rather breezy, survey of the history of animation.
Yeah, I mean, really how the animation business, as we know it, really sort of started, the infancy of it and how it came about. And there was some great stories in there. But I would recommend people to read it. I did see a couple of things that were not correct, but I wouldn't ding the book too much for those, because I think overall it was, really interesting stories.
Yeah. Another book that I've been reading off and on, and it's over 900 pages, which is why it's, again, it's taking so long. It's called Ninth Street Women, and it's by Mary Gabriel. It's a little brown book, was published in 2018. And it's a fascinating book about five women who dared to enter the male-dominated world of 20th century abstract painting, not as muses, but as artists. And it's really a riveting page turner. It has an intimate knowledge of these artists' lives and the male artists as well who were there, but mostly these five women who were overlooked, who played an important part in this new American art and school of painting. And among them are Lee Krasner, who was also the wife of Jackson Pollock, mm-hmm. the first celebrity couple of abstract art. And Elaine Kooning, who was the wife of Willem de Kooning.
Yeah.
There was Grace Hartig, who was a very bold painter, who abandoned life as a suburban wife and mother to become an artist. Joan Mitchell, who came from a privileged background, but had a stifling childhood and had a very fierce vision. And Helen Frankenthaler, who launched a new school of painting, which was the Color Field School. I remember seeing Frankenthaler's paintings at the Knoedler Gallery back in, say, 2008. My friend Beth Howland, the actress Beth Howland, and I went to see them. And I remember walking into the gallery and being just saturated, literally saturated by the colors, the way that the paint was applied there, some of the canvas, the raw canvas was showing, but the colors were extraordinary and they were all sort of floating there on the top of the canvas in some way. It was an extraordinary experience. But that's the sort of thing. This author describes, the process of being an artist. And one of the quotes that I thought was quite interesting was from Grace Hartigan, who said, when she faces the blank canvas, as you face the blank paper when you've animated, or as computer animators face the blank screen, she said, you are inside yourself to make a world. It's a terrifying experience, an unknown, and to pull all of your experience to try to make something is really part of the struggles of the creative process. And I think this book gets into the inside here and really gives credit where credit is due to these.
Yeah. I was going to say, is it Helen Frankenmuller? No.
Helen Frankenthaler.
She had a major show in the last few years, didn't she, at one of the museums in New York? I remember seeing a piece on one of the news magazine shows.
Yes, I believe she did. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're starting to get their due now, and they're starting to get the recognition that they so much deserve.
Yeah. And in a way, it's like Mary Blair is now getting enormous publicity, and her paintings are selling in the, $10,000, $15,000.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. Do you have another book you want to talk about?
Yeah, something? I read a very interesting book, and it's called Hemingway's Boat by Paul Hendrickson. Wow. And Paul Hendrickson, I believe, is a Washington Post reporter. He wrote, and this was a hefty book, John. This was a 650-page book. And I have to tell you, I was attracted to it because I had brought a couple of books with me up to Maine this past summer, and I plowed through those books, and I went into a shop and I saw this book on the shelf, and I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. I'm up here in Maine and there's all these boats around me and everything. I want to read about Hemingway's boat. But it was actually more of a biography that sort of talked about Hemingway and his life revolving around the boat that he bought. I thought it was just a very fascinating read. Of course, it talks about the history of the boat that he bought in the early 30s, and goes into, he was an avid sportsman, and one of the big things was, doing fishing in the Gulf Stream down off of Key West where he lived, and up in the Bimini Islands in the middle of the stream. Fishing for, the big trophy fish, the sailfish and those kinds of the marlin. And that's what he was going for. But he also did, some scientific research for the Philadelphia Museum of Natural History, and was tracking migrations and species and things like that for the museum. So it was a very fascinating look at Hemingway's life. And throughout all of these years that the author is chronicling around the boat and the fishing are all of his novels that he's writing. It was a very fascinating read, and I really enjoyed the book. I'd recommend it to anybody who's interested in Hemingway, fishing, boating. It sort of has a little of everything in there for people.
That's fascinating. I'm going to get it. Does it talk about the art of writing itself?
It doesn't really, but it talks a little bit about him, having writer's block, or, going on a tear when he starts writing something. So it talks about writing in the terms of how he dealt with it and his relationship to writing.
Well, because the other book, the third book that I'm reading at the moment is How to Live or Life of Montaigne by Sarah Bakewell. This is published in 2010. All of these three books are paperback, so they're available, easy to get. But Michel de Montaigne was born in 1553, and he died 59 years later, and he wrote essays. He was basically a 16th century magistrate in Bordeaux, France, and he was a wine producer and merchant, and he lived in a chateau with staff and servants. But he also is what we would call today the original blogger. 100 years ago, because he created the art of the personal essay between 1572 and 1592. He didn't write about war or politics or religion. He didn't try to teach or preach or explain anything. In his 107 essays, he merely asked himself questions. He asked himself, especially how to live, not how one should live. He was not interested in what one ought to do, but what they did. He was like a free-roaming writer of his thoughts and personal experiences. He's considered the first modern individual who wrote about the experiences of being human. He wrote about friendships. He wrote about smells, thumbs, diversion, experience. He's really the most human of writers, and that's something that 21st century readers find interesting about his work. I find it fascinating. He talked about getting over the death of a loved one, which, you know, is something everybody seems to be doing because of COVID. He talked about dealing with fanatics. He talked about making the most of every moment that you live. I just found it fascinating. He said, don't worry about death. He had a near-death experience when he was in his 30s. And he recalled as he was being carried, you know, from the accident to his home, he was bleeding, bones were broken, but he was in a sort of a kind of a coma, but it was a pleasant coma, as he recalled. He recalled the near-death experience as being something that just will take you away easily. He said, it's a quote, if you don't know how to die, don't worry. Nature will tell you what to do on the spot, fully and adequately. She will do this job perfectly for you. Don't bother your head about it, he wrote. He also found value in aging, which I was quite interested in. He saw aging as an opportunity to recognize one's fallibility in a way that youth often finds difficulty. You know, when you see your own decline in body and mind, he said, one accepts that one is limited and human. And so if you learn to live with the imperfection, you can even embrace it. I think even Marge Champion, my friend who was the model for Snow White and a great star at MGM, she said, don't think about what each decade takes away from you, but think what it brings to you instead. So she was sort of Montaigne-esque philosophy as well. He had an empathetic ability also to see things in another person's eyes. And even in his dog and his cat, he wondered what they were thinking. It's really fascinating to read his stuff. And this book goes into questions about how to live and questions, you know, and his answers about some of the possibilities.
That sounds like a really fascinating read.
Yeah, I thought so.
I read another book here that I want to mention is called Gossip Men, J. Edgar Hoover, Joe McCarthy, Roy Cohn, and the Politics of Insinuation. And it was written by Christopher Elias. It's a new book that came out earlier this year, but it's very interesting to read about that period in the you know, the late 1940s after World War II, when the Iron Curtain dropped across Europe. and the Red Scare and communism and you know, the Dies Committee, and you know, McCarthy was just coming into Congress, so it wasn't McCarthyism just yet. That would come in the early 50s, but you know, it really was an interesting read from the standpoint of the politics, and you know, the title says it, the politics of insinuation. They didn't have, you know, concrete evidence on some of these people. They just insinuated that they were communists. And that was enough to actually blacklist or ruin some of these people.
No, and they just went ahead and ruined a lot of people's lives.
They really did. And it's not unlike some of the stuff going on today, you know.
We're in a new McCarthy era, if you see what's going on in Washington, literally McCarthy.
Yeah, it really is. So yeah. I thought it was a timely, I'm sorry, what was that, John?
Nazis are back too, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. What's old is new again, you know? And, but you know, it was an interesting read, and to really see the parallels from then to now. But my gosh, I mean, there's so many great books out there. I wish I had more time to read a lot of them.
Yeah, I do too. You know, but the reading these books leads you to other subjects, other topics, and you know, that's always good as well.
It really is, and I think it gets the wheels going for ideas for future books. Yeah. You know, things that you know you may want to work on or think would make a good topic. I think there's so many great aspects of the animation world that can still be written about.
I think you should be writing a book on, you know what?
I know, you keep telling me that. You know, someday I'm going to do it. I think, you know, I think I'm going to have to put it in the queue.
You don't want them to think anything dirty, but it's special effects because
absolutely. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of effects artists who really helped develop the craft back in the 30s and 40s that to me have not been written about or really acknowledged, other than maybe a mention of their name someplace, you know, but very little from that standpoint. So I think that, you know, I've said, and I don't know how you feel about this, I've told people there are thousands of stories that could be written about Disney and animation and fascinating stories that just haven't been told yet.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of people. I mean, I would find them fascinating. The reason they're not done is because they're not known, and people, you know, don't buy books that they don't know what they're about or who they're about.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because like with my Claude Coates book, I was told that nobody knows who Claude is, you know, and I kind of felt like, well, if you tell a compelling story about somebody who worked on all this magnificent, you know, films and theme park attractions, people who are fans of those films and theme park attractions are going to go, oh my gosh, I know that name. You know, yeah. He worked on Pinocchio, or he worked on Pirates of the Caribbean. I want to read about him.
Yes, but I guess the larger publishers will not go for it because they want volume. Sales.
But no, you know, certainly, you know, they want books that are going to sell 500,000 copies or 100,000 copies or whatever it is. But still, I think that there's a market. And I can tell you, by the way, for the Claude Coates book, I would not be surprised, but I think the first print run is nearly sold out or will be sold out by Christmas. So to me, you know, if you read statistically about the book industry, they say the average nonfiction book only sells 300 to 500 copies. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? The Claude Coates book blew that out of the water, you know, because I know the book has sold a tremendous amount. So, and it's going to go into a second printing. So, you know, the bottom line is that I think people are relying too much on individuals making decisions about which books get made. And those are people who don't know You know, there was a major publisher who, you know, the sales force said, well, we don't know who Claude Coates is. How do we sell that book? Mm-hmm. You know, we shouldn't do that book because we can't sell it. And you're like, what?
You know, you sell it to hardcore fans. And that's the great thing about where we're at now, is that there are pockets of fans that share the same mindset, that want to know more, that are thirsty and hungry for these type of things. And they find podcasts, they find videos, they find everything they can and consume it, and they get around, and then they find people like yourselves and they buy all they can.
Well, I have to tell you, I've gotten some lovely notes from people on my past books. And John, I'm sure you've gotten the same. And there is an audience out there that is hungry for these kinds of books, you know, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be made. But again, I think, you know, with some of these publishers, they, like you said, John, they're just looking to do tremendous volume.
Well, get on that special effects book.
Al John, what have you read lately?
You know, it's funny. Before I get into that, I will tell you that you can pick up John Kanemaker's book at finer bookstores around you, because I know a lot of Disney fans out there that bought the Mary Blair book. So I think you can go out there and pick that up, as well as also giving a plug for the very rare, now Raggedy Ann and Andy book, which you can find right now for around $800 for a first edition hardcover. I just wanted to put that out
there. Isn't that amazing, John? That's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing. I'm not getting any of that.
It's time to reissue that book.
As an NFT, a non-fungible token.
That's it. Well, I appreciate you asking, Dave. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting. I spend my time in the rock and roll realm, in the music realm a lot, and have befriended a lot of great people. And Mark Weiss, a photographer extraordinaire, who did a ton of rock and roll photography over the years. And he put out a great book that is co-authored by Richard Beanstock, who's also an awesome rock and roll writer, along with afterword by Eddie Trunk, you know, DJ, as well as VH1 video host, and Rob Halford as well. And this is The Decade That Rocked, the photography of Mark Wise Guy Weiss. And you can see a bunch of those, as well as great stories from the 80s, the decade of decadence, if you will. Photos, great stories there, from Guns N' Roses to Joan Jett to Van Halen. So you can definitely check that out. And then I will also follow that up by yet another great book, also by Richard Beanstock, called Nothing But a Good Time, which is in there as well. So
I was just gonna interject here, Al John, and say, do you feel like there's like one rock and roll photographer per decade? Because, you know, we talked last week or a couple weeks ago about Mick Rock,
yes,
who is a rock and roll photographer who really dominated the 70s. Mm-hmm. He still shot into the 80s and 90s, but his big decade was the 70s. And your friend, his decade is sort of the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you look at those photographers, and they really did have all access to those different places, those different decades, if you will, you know? So yeah, definitely. I believe that. And I think, you know, once again, you know, photography and those types of, those kind of art books are just absolutely amazing. I mean, we just had as I mentioned, a Ross Halfen documentary we put on Gibson TV called Through the Lens. And, you know, Ross Halfen also has amazing books out there of his work and the way he stages photography and the way he shoots bands. I mean, anyway, I could go on and on, but yes, every decade has just a prolific, you know, rock and roll photographer that has all access.
John, do you know who the first photographer, when the Beatles came to America, was there a first photographer, someone who stayed with them for a long time, and, you know, when they were first coming to America?
You know, I believe so. And I think one of them was Robert Freeman. And Robert Freeman had a lot of the, he was an English photographer, but did a lot of those type of photographs from back in the day, and you can, in fact, you mentioned that, and I just, you know, literally just called him up and tried to see if he had a book.
There was another photographer, and his name slips my mind at the moment, but his son is managing the archive of negatives, but he shot the Beatles quite a bit on their first tour of the U.S.
There are a bunch of those. And I'm trying to think offhand, Jerry Chatsberg, he did a bunch of photos, especially in the New York area. Bob Dylan comes to mind. I think he shot a couple of Bob Dylan album covers as well.
So a
couple of those, but absolutely. I mean, I'm just fascinated by that stuff. And I love to get not just art, but also photography and frame it and put it in different places, but definitely check that out. And for a couple things, I also wanted to get some parents out there. You want your kids to have some really light reading. And these are a few things I think the parents could check out. Be More Captain America, Lessons in Leadership. It's 10 bucks. And they're really cool things that you can put on your kid's mantle, right? So, for example, here's a quote from Captain America from Marvel Comics. If you get hurt, hurt him back. If you get killed, walk it off. Captain America. You know, attitude goes a long way. No one wants the Avengers to come up with a bunch of dubious excuses or for them to watch Thanos make half of the universe disappear and then say, oh, well, you win some, you lose some. Heroes say stuff like, let's do it, or I'm going in, and they mean it. Learn to make inspiring, sometimes bold remarks. Hey, your public expects it. So that's an interesting read. And then also light reading. Here's a book called Star Wars, I Love You. I know. Lessons in Love and Friendship. All right. And so, of course, this is about on the cover, Princess Leia and Han Solo. And so there's a couple different things I think kids can learn here. And it says, learn to say I love you. All right. One comes from royalty. The other's a pirate. But Han and Leia don't let their different backgrounds and communication styles get in the way of their romance. Some scruffy looking nerf herders may show you they love you before they actually say it out loud. They might even show their love by offering you the last bite of their favorite snack. And while more likely to give your partner lavish compliments or write them a love letter, the key is to stay tuned for what the other person needs. Remember, what's really important is that you both feel loved. So there you go. Light reading for the kiddos.
We need a lot more love in this world. That's
no
for sure.
No kidding. Yes, that's what it's all about. And more Beatles songs, you know, from the vault. So come on, let's release more Beatles songs and documentaries from the vault, shall we?
John, I'm curious. I want to ask you, and Al John, I'll ask you this, but do you have a collection of books that you've accumulated over the years? And for me, like I've got bookcases in a couple different rooms of the house, and we have a library. One room is actually a library, and then we have bookcases in a couple other rooms, including my office. But I just love buying a beautifully crafted book and not only reading it, but going back and referencing it from time to time and having that on the shelf in my home. I mean, how do you feel about that?
I agree completely. I love different things and like to have the books there if I want to reference something. And it's not just animation books, but it's books about nature and dinosaurs.
Yeah,
all sorts of subject matter. No, it's great. Somebody said you should. If you buy a book, you should give two away. It's difficult, though, isn't it? You want to just hold.
I have to say it's very difficult, to give away books that you've accumulated over time. I have no problem giving away my books. You know, I get a supply of books, so I'm happy to send books out to friends and just as a gift and say, hey, here's my latest work and I hope you enjoy it, you know. That's kind of how I look at it. But I'd be hard pressed I tried it once, by the way. You know, our library, the bookcases in the library were teeming where we were sticking books into, you know, every little nook and cranny and sitting them on top of books and stuff. And we tried to go through and sort of cull out books that, you know, we felt like we could give away. But it was tough, I have to say.
Books are like albums. You know, I feel like when you have a good book, it gives you that snapshot in that time of your life. And you do like to reference them. And I think they also form, you form a relationship with a book. You have a lot of comfort that you can take in when you get a good book. And yeah, it's difficult. But I do feel like books are some of the most thoughtful gifts you can give someone.
Yes. Whether they want them or not.
Is that a strong hint, John? Have you ever tried to give a strong hint to someone? It's like, maybe you should give this a read. I mean, being that you're a professor, I'm sure you've come across a lot of students that I think would benefit from, you know, having you set aside and say, you know, maybe you could give this book a read. It might help you a lot.
I do. And I have a lot of books in my office, and I'm starting to, you know, deaccession them by giving them to students and just, you know, letting them, you know, form their own opinions about them.
Absolutely. You know, I'm curious, you know, because we have a very diverse audience that's global, by the way, John. We have a global audience for this podcast. We've got listeners in Taiwan and the UK and Australia and South America. So I'm always being asked by people, oh, you know, I have a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old and they're interested in animation. Do you have any books you can recommend? And one of the books I always tell people to get is Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson's The Illusion of Life, Disney Animation, because it walks you through the whole process and philosophy of Disney classical animation. And we've talked on our show about the Walter Foster book, you know, Preston Blair's The Art of Animation. So, but do you have any favorites that you recommend to students?
Yes, I think in terms of technique, the Richard Williams book, you know, an animator's survival kit.
Yeah.
Quite essential. I like, you know, several of the, you know, history books, including the Walter Foster book that you mentioned, the Preston Blair book. Yeah. And Frank and Ollie's, of course, is a superior book as well. So, yeah. I recommend those.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the Richard Williams, they also did, I think, a DVD series of the book as well.
Yes.
Of his lectures, which I think is now available like for digital download. But I mean, I knew Richard, you knew Richard. What an incredible talent he was, and what a mark he left.
Yes, he was quite amazing as a draftsperson and as an animator, and you know, just a great down to earth person. I felt, you know, I had a relationship with him for about 30 years.
You know, I remember him telling me when he had his studio on Soho Square in London. He told me, we had a whole conversation about this one day, but he was telling me about how he just loved to go and sit out in the square and just watch people walk and the types of walks. He just went into this whole, you know, description of different kinds of walks and different gaits that people have, and the quirkiness of how we as human beings walk.
A documentary in which he is there in Soho Square watching the people, and then he's commenting on them, and he's also scribbling over them, and you can see the walk going. And he says, well, that's a march walk there. That's 12 frames and blah, blah, blah. It's really worth, you know, a lot of documentaries on the making of animation.
Yes. Yeah. So what's your favorite on the making of animation? What's your favorite documentary?
Oh, gosh. Well, I just showed the Frederick Bach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's really quite wonderful. He's interviewed, and then they show clips, you know, of his films. And in class yesterday, I showed that particular one as well. But you go onto YouTube, and it's terrific. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful source for all kinds of information all kinds of demonstrations of animation and such. People can, you know, educate themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Frederick Bach did The Man Who Planted Trees. And it was The River or?
Crack. Crack was the other one.
Crack. Yeah, and
which got the Oscar also. He got two Oscars.
Yeah.
Times, and he got two Oscars.
It's absolutely amazing to watch his short films. They were beautifully done, beautifully executed.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, there we are.
Yeah, I think we got a lot of information packed into this show. There's some wonderful books. Al John's going to be putting the links up and you guys can find that in the show notes when the show is up. I don't know. What are you looking forward to for the holidays, John? Are there any films that you're looking forward to?
I've just seen about 84 films, short films, animated films for the Academy because I'm
a
member. So I've seen quite a lot of.
Well, you're way ahead of me. I got the link in the mail in an email today, and I'm going to have to slog through a lot of that. Did you find that there was a lot of good material?
No.
yeah, which is typical. I mean, you know, I think our audience should know, because John, you're an Academy Award winner and you're in the Academy and you vote on the Academy Awards in the animation branch. And I do the same. But there's what's called the bake-off, I guess, is kind of one description of it. But you get all of these entries and they have to boil it down to just a handful. And out of that handful, they actually get the nominations. So the handful is really the bake-off to get the nominations.
Yeah, the short list, as they call it.
Yeah, the short list, and but you have to go through all of these other animated films, and they're shorts. But a short is anything under 45 minutes.
I think a little less than that, but I'm not sure. A lot of them are about 18 minutes or so.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them are just too long.
Yeah.
Way too long for the story they're telling. but there's also gems in there.
Yes, absolutely.
There really are. And you don't know it until you kind of start to chomp through and watch them. And I'm actually glad that they're allowing us to stream those shorts through the Academy portal. Yes. And watch them in the comfort of our homes, because years ago we'd have to go down to the Samuel Goldwyn Theater for like an entire day, and you know, it was sort of like, you know, on some of the longer ones, you if enough hands went up, they'd stop it and move on to the next one.
I was always fascinated by that process, because I figured at this point in time that you'd be able to get all of the links to all of that stuff to view it, because it seems to me like that is a process. That is quite the process.
It is.
There's also the fact that we enjoyed getting together in person, and we miss that here in New York.
Yeah.
The Canadian contingent would come down, because they always had a lot of films and still do, you know, in the competition, and we would all have dinner afterwards. So it was a very social thing, and we kind of missed that. It was over a 2-day period.
Yeah. Same out here. I mean, you know, when you go to those screenings in person, you know, it's a chance to catch up with folks. And I have to say, you know, being in this pandemic for the last 18 months or so, a couple weeks ago, Nancy and I actually went to a gallery. It was a Saturday, one night only. George Scribner, who directed Prince and the Pauper, and who directed Oliver and Company, and he became an Imagineer. He's a prolific painter. And so he had a one night only gallery show for charity. The money raised from the paintings he sold was going directly into an art institute that was helping children with art. We went to that, and it was like a class reunion. You know, Don Hahn was there and Gary Trousdale and, you know, all of these different people, Sonny Apichapong and, you know, Barry Atkinson, all these folks that we hadn't seen in, you know, now almost going on 2 years, you know, 18 months plus. And it's wonderful. What's that?
Put some pictures of that on your Facebook page?
I put a couple pictures up. Where there was a picture of George and I in front of us, a board that had information about his Panama Canal paintings. Because, you know, George did an 8-year painting. What's the word I'm grasping for here? He had a commission. He had an 8-year commission to paint the expansion of the Panama Canal. You know, they did the wider canal next to the existing original Panama Canal. And George went down there, you know, 5-6 times a year and painted over an 8-year period. And so he's got 40 paintings that are going on display at the National Gallery in Panama in May of next year. So he had a few of those paintings there. They weren't for sale, but he was just showing them and sort of letting people know that the gallery exhibition at the National Gallery in Panama was going to be happening.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, but it's so true when you get together with when you go to those kinds of events, they do become a reunion of friends and people that you haven't seen in a while.
Well, I want to wish you both a happy Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. And I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you soon. I want to thank you for being back on the Skull Rock podcast to do our annual book show. Hint, hint, John, I'll be tapping you next year. and hopefully I'm going to see you in person over the Christmas holidays.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. All right. See you soon. Bye-bye, John.
Bye.
Skull Rock Podcast.
To infinity and beyond.
Exploring the outer reaches of the Disney galaxy.
Whoa! Oh, wow, you flew magnificently.
Always fun to have Mr. Kingmaker on the show.
I love John Kingmaker. And you know something? I will be visiting with him over the Christmas holidays when we're in New York. And he's a terrific friend, and he's a wonderful person to just sit down and chat with. You know, and I just really look forward to getting together with him whenever I go back to the East Coast.
I love it. Absolutely. And so many great recommendations for books. If you're just starting your journey into art or animation, to please check out the links. We're going to have a wish list of different books that were mentioned throughout the course of the show. So you can please check that out. And then, of course, also adding Dave's book list as well. You know, pick up yourself something nice for the holidays is what I'm saying.
I would agree. Treat yourself. You Treat know yourself. You want to. Yeah. Just do it.
Don't deny yourself the opportunity. Far be it for us to deny you of anything. We do have some awesome shows coming up in the weeks to come, especially for the holidays. And, you know, we just can't wait for you to just once again just listen to us and enjoy and open up some great surprises in the form of the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love the show, once again, if you stumbled upon us, please subscribe. We do appreciate you supporting the show on every podcast platform. Follow us on those social media links as well, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and be sure to send us those emails, dave@skullrockpodcast.com and aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com. Dave, it's all you.
Well, as always, Al John, peace and love to everybody out there. You know, we're going into the holiday seasons, and, you know, just slow down a little bit. Take your time. Enjoy yourselves. And we will look forward to having you back here next week on the Skull Rock Podcast.
Skull Rock Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. We'd love to thank Charles, Lindsay, Spencer, and Joshua. To support this podcast to sustain future episodes, visit anchor.fm/Skull Rock Podcast. I'm Al John Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock Podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.